This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. State Farm's exit from downtown Bloomington is affecting some of the businesses that remain. A county board member says downtowns are always rebuilding.
No downtown is built. We're constantly building them.
Carlo Robustelli's district includes downtown. You'll also hear from Bloomington aldermen, city officials, and business owners about proposals on the table to revitalize the city's downtown. Judy Valente and Colleen Reynolds report. During the GLT Datebook, Laura Kennedy tells you how a Phantom of the Opera-themed event will raise money for the arts. And you'll hear from former Fugazi drummer Brandon Canty. GLT's John Norton talks with him about Mesthetics, the new band formed by Canty and the former bassist for Fugazi. The band plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, May 7th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For several decades, city officials have discussed how to revitalize downtown Bloomington. State Farm's decision to move its employees out of its downtown office tower leaves yet another landmark vacant and puts additional pressure on city planners to act. The Downtown Bloomington Task Force issued what it called a final report last October, but is the city any nearer to taking any action? GLT's Judy Valente has this report.
It's the noon hour on a warm, sunny spring day in downtown Bloomington. Cars and buses move along Front Street. Delivery trucks unload their contents on side streets. But there are few pedestrians. A lone downtown worker eats a sandwich at a table in the courtyard outside the Law and Justice Center. The closing of State Farm's office building on East Street has hit downtown hard. The towering brick building, topped by the company name in red lights, was State Farm's original headquarters. It remained a downtown anchor for 89 years. Once, 900 people worked there. The last of the building's 150 employees moved out in February. Bloomington City Council member Amelia Burgess represents the downtown area.
We have more vacant buildings today than we did 10 years ago, and that's a problem. It's a problem without an easy solution.
For nearly a decade, city officials have debated how to best revitalize downtown. There have been two major studies, but Burgess says little action.
I was just reviewing some media coverage from 8 years ago this morning to refresh my memory on a few things and found an article talking about the need to come up with a plan for the Market Street Garage, which was reaching the end of its useful lifespan. 8 years later, we have no plan.
Burgess now chairs the Downtown Bloomington Task Force. She says State Farm's exit serves as a wake-up call. It joins three other major downtown landmarks now empty: the front and center building, the C2 East building, and the old Pantograph headquarters. Business owners have been feeling the effects of those empty buildings for some time, and the loss of State Farm only worsens the situation. Tricia Stiller is executive director of the Downtown Bloomington Association, an office that represents business owners and last year became part of city government.
The restaurants, the eateries, the places to take a coffee break, those folks are feeling it immediately. But, you know, we have been resilient and we have survived many, many times over, and I'm confident we'll be able to do that again.
Business owners remain concerned. Kelly Mathey owns Kelly's Bakery on Center Street, a popular lunch spot. She says there used to be a daily line of customers out the door at lunchtime.
In terms of a percentage, we're down about 25%, which in the restaurant industry, that's a pretty significant number.
Mathy says she expects her restaurant to weather the downturn by diversifying its offerings.
If you're innovative and you're willing to change a little bit, I just recently started keto baking. We started gluten-free baking and things that we had never tried before, but we were trying to reach a new demographic, and we're trying to stay relevant.
Butch Thompson has owned restaurants downtown since the early 1980s. His Reality Bites restaurant used to be open for lunch and dinner 5 days a week. It's still open nights, but is closed for lunch now on Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
Part of that is because of the people that left State Farm. Part of it's just because, you know, we're four blocks away from where most of the workers are instead of one block. Three or four blocks extra, you know, during rain or during winter or things like that makes a difference. And even when State Farm only had a few hundred people, well, if you got 5% of them, you know, that 20, 30 people every day.
Thompson, who also owns Elroy's and Daddy-O's and the Reality on Monroe event space, says his overall level of sales has remained fairly constant over the nearly 35 years he's been a downtown business owner. He says he's frustrated that downtown hasn't changed more.
And I don't have the answer as of why. There I go back again. Is that a mayor thing? Is that a council? You know, who is at fault? You know, everybody talks about, well, we don't have enough money to do this. We don't have enough money to do that.
McLean County Board member Carlo Robustelli stands at the corner of Front and Center Streets, looking up at a handsome multi-story building that has been vacant for years. It's the Front and Center building. The structure stands just a few blocks from the old State Farm offices and also is near the McLean County History Museum.
When you think about this building location, it's located sort of connecting the core of our downtown with the History Museum on one side and on the other side, the Coliseum. And so there's just tremendous redevelopment opportunity here that would be synergistic between the museum on one corner and the Coliseum on the other.
One problem, though, is that the Front and Center building, like the State Farm office, and other vacant buildings are privately owned, and the city has to work with those owners on what happens next to those buildings.
That is something as a community we're going to have a serious discussion about. What are the kinds of opportunities that exist, whether it's a partnership with a nonprofit or it's a partnership with a for-profit?
The city's most recent downtown plan recommends a multi-pronged approach. It calls for upgrading public spaces, adding green space by planting more trees, flowers, and native shrubs, including more public art, improving street parking, and making the streets generally more attractive to pedestrians by adding decorative crosswalks and more attractive night lighting. Both city officials and business owners agree one thing downtown already has is an ample supply of residential housing units. Many of them were developed in recent years.
There's a slight difference between residential unit availability downtown, which I think over the last 10 years we have seen an increase, and the need to bring in a catalytic project that would draw more potential customers to support local businesses.
The biggest challenge remains finding what planners call catalyst projects. Projects that would bring more people who don't live downtown into the area on a regular basis. Downtown Task Force Chair Amelia Burgess says finding the right fit is tricky.
So can a hotel be a catalyst project? Maybe. It depends on the hotel. It depends on its size. It depends on its market. So is that a catalyst? Maybe. That also changed my perception of certain projects we've done. I think if you ask most people about the Coliseum, they'd say that was intended to be a catalyst. But it doesn't meet that definition, right? It doesn't bring people down here to downtown on a daily basis.
Other options include converting some of the vacant buildings into a hotel convention center, or a multi-use facility that might include a community center, some private housing, offices, and retail space. The city has also considered knocking down the Market Street parking deck, which is aging and needs repair, and replacing it with one of these projects.
When it comes to revitalization, we have the smaller projects that can still have a big impact, and then we have the larger projects that are more complicated and more costly. So it can be as little as better landscaping, making sure that our streets and our sidewalks are clean, in good repair. Those are some of the really basic things. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have those larger catalyst-style projects.
Revitalization efforts can be characterized so far mainly by what has not worked out. A proposal to locate a new public library within the downtown area appears stalled, and a proposal to place the new YMCA building there floundered.
If we're not going to talk about those possibilities that have already been put out there and that are in our plans, we've got to have alternatives. And it can't just be, I don't like that idea, I hope we find a better one.
Kelly Matthey of Kelly's Bakery says one thing many business owners don't want to change is the local character of downtown.
Downtown has got the benefit of very, very few box stores, right? We've got a couple, but not very many. It's pretty locally owned businesses and a lot of people who are doing different things for the community and trying to offer unique opportunities.
I prefer it to be grassroots and local.
Ken Mishka owns the Epiphany Farms and Anjou Above restaurants on Front Street.
I don't want to see developers from Chicago and St. Louis come in here and develop the building next to me. I want to see other local folks doing it.
Mishka is bullish on downtown. He plans to open a new restaurant in the coming weeks in the 500 block of Main Street at a site where he currently does the baking for his other two restaurants.
My team's there from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., and we always thought it would be awesome to let the bakery turn into a restaurant at night.
Mishka's new restaurant is called the Bakery and Pickle Bar.
You know, downtown Bloomington has so much value when it comes to our community and our area, our culture. The history here is amazing. The people are amazing. I think I love being here. I don't want to go anywhere else. Why look at it in a pessimistic point of view?
Mishka says real estate prices remain attractive for business owners.
I've looked at properties in Normal, and it's like at $22 a square foot for a restaurant, it's like I can't, as a small business owner, come even close to affording that. Yet in downtown Bloomington, you're going to find deals that are like 7, 12, 11, 10. I see an immense amount of opportunity in that.
Vicki Tilton, who owns the Fox and Hounds Hair Salon and its building on Monroe and Center Streets, says she too is in downtown to stay. She acknowledges recent developments are troubling, but sees in them opportunities.
We have a different council, city council, with a different mindset about downtown, and we feel comfortable that they have some good vision and direction, and for the most part, they're working together. There's still a few that kind of don't get it.
What's the difference between a Berkey and one of these filtration systems? So you put it on your counter and then...
Common Ground Grocery seems to model the kind of locally owned, locally grown business many city officials and owners like Tilton say they want to see more of in downtown. The shop that sells organically grown produce, vegan, and fair trade products has been a fixture on Main Street for four decades. Owner Lua Travis says the store lost some walk-in lunchtime business when State Farm employees left, but credits the store's longevity to a loyal customer base.
It's all about the customers. We have some who have been shopping here for the whole 40 years that we've been here. I think that they like coming to us. We're very personal with our customers. I hope they continue to like coming to us.
At 3:30 one recent afternoon, a steady stream of customers entered the store to look for items ranging from water filters to homemade soup to espresso spice. Peggy Flynn says she drives across Bloomington to shop there.
Just because I've been coming here since it opened and I love it.
Tricia Stiller, the head of the Downtown Trade Association, says part of downtown's problem is that too many people still don't give it a chance.
Downtown gets overlooked a lot. People don't even realize that we have thriving, unique retailers in our downtown. We have more than 30 retailers, which people think, oh, that can't possibly be true. But it really is. We have wonderful art galleries. We have wonderful entertainment venues. And I think that, you know, perhaps people haven't given downtown a new look in many, many years.
Stiller says the public will already see some changes. Murals now adorn some of the downtown buildings and traffic boxes. Plans are underway to add greenery to the corner of Mulberry and Main, currently a desert of asphalt and concrete. And last month, the county board approved plans to remove dying trees and shrubs in the Law and Justice Center courtyard and replace them with new plants and flowers. Stiller says additional proposals are under consideration, including for the State Farm building.
There's lots of wonderful opportunities to be creative in our reuse of that beautiful space. It's been wonderfully maintained. It's gorgeous. I would love to see some higher-end retailer dining on the lower level and either residential or residential space above, or perhaps even a boutique hotel. We've talked and talked and talked about a location, and perhaps one is presenting itself to us now.
One of the things government officials have yet to discuss in detail is how much the proposed beautification projects will cost. Robert Mart, Bloomington's Director of Community Development, says the city is working on those estimates now. Discussions are likely to go on through the next budget cycle, and pressure to cut costs remains. Burgess of the City Council and Robustelli of the County Board insist there will be a cost to the city's tax base by simply doing nothing.
No downtown, including Uptown Normal, is built. We're constantly building them.
Robustelli points out the city has a vision and even a roadmap for downtown. What's needed now is the will to put those plans into action. I'm Judy Valente.
While some of the plans for downtown, such as fresh landscaping, may take place soon, Downtown Bloomington Task Force members say the public probably won't see most of the other improvements the city is considering for another 3 to 5 years. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds also reported for this story, and News Director Charlie Schlinger helped produce the story. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Eye Credit Union, a not-for-profit, member-owned financial cooperative, now helping members and their families protect their personally identifiable information with every secure checking account. More information at MidIlliniICU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A report by the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform found that early voting numbers in Illinois are increasing, with 22% of voters casting ballots before the March primary day. IPR's Mary Cullen talks with Policy Director Colin Williams, who discusses the benefits of early voting.
It really is more convenient for voters, especially voters who want to go out to vote the weekend before Election Day or up to 2 weeks before Election Day is when you get the most convenience for voters.
More Illinoisans voted before the March primary this year than 2 years ago. So why are we seeing an increase?
So a lot of the early voting increases that we've seen are in Cook County and Chicago and the Collar counties, as well as in Champaign County. And those counties really do a lot to make sure that early voting is accessible for their voters by having extra polling places open, really advertising and encouraging voters to get out and vote early. So it's really, on one hand, a national trend towards an increase of early voting, as well as those election officials really putting in the work to get voters turned out earlier than Election Day.
What do you think makes the difference between a county like Champaign County and, for example, Hardin County, where the report shows that 100% of all votes were cast on Election Day?
A lot of it is in the culture of the places that are voting, and I mean, like, voting culture. So in Hardin County, there were 900 votes cast in the primary election in 2018, and the county clerk's office was the only early voting location. And so when you have such a small community, it's likely that Election Day is kind of ingrained in the culture of a lot of these smaller counties. There's not as many resources to have early voting sites open across the county that are convenient for people. On the other side of that, Champaign County, they do have the ability and the resources and the motivation to open up all those extra early voting sites. And you really see the results of that in their early voting percentages. I mean, 40% of people coming out to vote early is incredible. That's the highest in the state by like 8 to 10%.
So looking into Cook County, 27% of votes were cast before Election Day.
Yeah.
How would you say that compares to other big cities in other states?
So in Los Angeles, Los Angeles has the California system of these really high early voting, vote-by-mail rates. And so 27% is relatively low. Now, if you look at the other side, if you look at New York City, New York doesn't allow early voting at all. They don't have any sort of early voting. You have to have an excuse to vote absentee. So kind of the two other larger cities than Chicago, you see one where you have these really high percentages in LA, and then the other where early voting isn't even allowed by law.
Would you say we're going to be seeing a change? I know in the report it shows that New York is actually going to start practicing early voting in 2019. Is this a trend that we're going to see happen across the country?
Especially with concerns about the security of elections and making sure that our technology is secure and efficient, early voting really allows election authorities across the country to make sure that those priorities are in place without it breaking the bank. Between the cost savings, the security benefits, the convenience to voters, it's really just a matter of changing early voting culture across the country to get more people engaged and wanting to vote early. And I think that's going to be happening more and more as time goes on, both in Illinois and across the country.
Illinois Campaign for Political Reform Policy Director Colin Williams talked with IPR's Mary Cullen. Here on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. What are members of the former cult punk band Fugazi up to? Well, the bass player and drummer play as part of a new band, The Mesthetics, at Night Shop tonight. GLT's John Norton talks with former Fugazi drummer coming up. Why spend $250 million on a new veterans home in Quincy? The Illinois Politics Roundtable deals with that question. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, along with Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney of WBEZ in Chicago. McKinney starts by laying out the history of the problems with the Quincy veterans home.
Well, yeah, it goes back to 2015, and that's when there was this just kind of out of control outbreak there, where people were getting sick and dying from this waterborne illness. And the thing you should point out about Legionnaire's disease, I mean, it's a preventable thing. I mean, you can prevent it from, you know, making sure your water system is purified. But then on the back end, if somebody gets sick with this, typically antibiotics will treat it. And so those things were obviously not working there in Quincy, and the whole thing blew up there. And it's become this real problem for Governor Rauner because, you know, in spite of spending about $6 million to upgrade the water system there and put in new testing protocols, people kept getting sick. They got sick in 2016. They got sick again in 2017 when there was a 13th victim who died. And then in February, there were four more people who got sick. And so, you know, at this point, we're now kind of in really the fourth year of this. And it's, as I said, a real anvil around Governor Rauner's campaign here. He's got to get it under control. And this week, he proposed a package of proposals to do that, $245 million, $250 million to build an entirely new facility there, to get a new water supply, and in the interim buy an abandoned nursing home nearby that they could retrofit and upgrade to move people in while construction continues.
Well, Tony, a lot of people have discussed this over the last few years and different ways to approach this problem. Is it really the only way to do this, to just tear down that facility, pull out all of the plumbing and start from scratch, or is there another solution that could even be cheaper?
Well, I guess, first of all, it's been found that a main perpetrator for the people getting sick has been these old water pipes there on the Quincy campus. And so I think there's been some logic about how do you tear out those pipes, replace them, and not disrupt the lives of the people who are living there, who call this place home. So now that they've been looking at this issue here the last several months, with a few new commissions on just the infrastructure of the facility and also just, you know, the water at the place itself, they've come to the conclusion that just ripping up the pipes isn't enough. We should build a whole new building while we're at it, because the next generation of veterans who are going to be looking to stay there are going to have different health issues than the ones who are there currently. Veterans from Vietnam, or even in the future from Afghanistan and Iraq, will probably have more mental health needs than the ones who have been living there traditionally. And they're saying that they're going to need a different type of a building altogether to address that.
Charlie, the governor has done everything from going to stay at the Quincy Veterans Home for about a week and living there and seeing firsthand what was going on, and then also having this more comprehensive report put together that came out this week. But has his response just been too little too late?
I don't know if I could say it's too little too late, although I was among many people who suggested, you know, months ago that maybe what we should do is find temporary housing while we try and settle this problem. But it is a situation that I think, as the WBEZ reporting showed, it could have been dealt with at the onset with a greater sense of urgency, notifying people's families immediately rather than waiting several days, that sort of thing. And I think, in my mind, what we need to do now is stop blaming people or looking for people to blame, and for the legislature and the governor to just get together, pass an appropriation to fund a new building, and get going on it.
And Dave, what's the status on that? I know that the legislature is supposed to be in through the end of this month at least. Is there any movement out there? I believe J.B. Pritzker has even said, hey, they should act on this plan.
Well, yesterday Pritzker was asked about, do you have any concerns with what the governor put out? And, he didn't identify any kinds of red flags to him, and he urged action on a plan. But we're talking about doing this in the heat of a very heated political cycle, and a governor who has had difficulties working with the Democratic-led legislature and has not gotten a lot accomplished because of the fighting, and I think there could be motivation on the part of Democrats to try to slow walk this and keep him kind of twisting in the wind during the summer. But there are risks in a strategy like that, where if something happens over there, more people get sick, or God forbid somebody else dies, then a whole new round of finger pointing begins. And if Democrats don't give him what he wants, then I think he's sort of empowered to turn this back on them and say, well, wait a minute, I have a plan here. What are you guys not doing approving it?
And I would add to that, too, when you look at how legislatively lawmakers have been dealing with this issue since our reporting came out, began back in December. Most legislation that's come up related to the Quincy home has passed unanimously. There's been bills related to notifying families of outbreaks on campus. There's been bills about getting an audit of what happened. What did the administration do? Did they act appropriately? And also of raising the bar. Right now, families who are suing the state for neglect because their loved one died from this outbreak, they're entitled, the most they can win is $100,000, and there's some legislation out there to raise that amount to $2 million. So and so far those bills have gotten bipartisan support. They're still in the legislative process. They haven't gotten to the governor's desk yet. But I think what you're seeing is a very different type of. You might see a different type of approach to spending $245 million for a new facility there.
Well, we had this situation, going on now for several years, actually. And, of course, a lot of the reporting that both you and Dave did here over the last few months has even brought it to more people's attention. And then we had this report come out this week. At the same time, we have an email that is made public, and this comes from Governor Rauner's Deputy Chief of Staff, Darlene Singer, former state lawmaker. She's also running for statewide office right now for controller, and apparently seemed to raise the possibility that the Quincy outbreak, maybe there was a way to tie it to the previous administration when the now U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth was in charge of the Department of Affairs. Is this Veterans Affairs? Is this a big issue? Is this a big deal politically for the governor? Is this just one of those things that's going to run its course and we'll forget about it?
Well, I mean, I think the email is kind of a portal into the thinking that was going on in the administration at a key point in time. I mean, this coincides with the first report that we did in December, where we were the first people to really kind of give voice to these families who explained kind of the horrible circumstances of not knowing what was going on as they were watching their family members get sick and die. And the fallout from that was intense. And within about a day or day and a half is when this email string comes out. I mean, the state senator from DuPage County, Tom Cullerton, who has been leading hearings into the Legionnaires outbreak after our coverage, he proposed early on, almost immediately after our story back in December, that there be an audit by the Auditor General's office about what these outbreaks, what happened with them. And so internally in the governor's office, they were circulating this news story. And then at one point, Darlene Singer, who was the governor's legislative liaison at that point, weighs in and says, as you point out, maybe we could tie this back to Tammy Duckworth. Duckworth is the Democratic U.S. Senator, of course, and she was the state veteran affairs director from 2006 to 2009. And the problem with Singer's thinking there is that there were no confirmed cases of Legionnaires at the facility prior to 2015. A lot of that has to do with there was not really any consistent testing going on and really a lot of ignorance there about, what is a case of pneumonia? Is it Legionnaires or is it just viral, a viral pneumonia? What is it? And so that was the strategy there. But this has really blown up in her face.
Democrats might also be playing politics by slow walking measures to address the problem in an effort to tie the issue to the Rauner administration. Lawmakers will be in session through the end of the month and will have an opportunity to act on the Quincy Veterans Home issue. Sean Crawford moderates the Illinois Politics Roundtable today with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield and Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney of WBEZ. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. University of Illinois administrators want to see the Urbana campus move on without Chief Alinowick. They're seeking input from the community on how best to achieve that. IPR's Christine Herman spoke with people at an event to learn what they see as a path forward.
In the South Lounge of the Illini Union, tall tables with post-it notes and pens are scattered throughout the middle of the room. Large poster printouts line the perimeter.
It's turning out really well, I think.
That's Rusty Barcelo. She's a visiting special assistant to the chancellor, brought in specifically to help with issues related to equity and diversity. Each poster has a theme, written in large font at the top and a wide open space at the bottom where attendees place post-it notes with their answers to questions, such as, how do we respect our past while also moving forward? And what education do we need as a community?
This is an opportunity to be open. It's a model that I've used before at other institutions. It's a good way to give people voice.
The plan, she says, is to collect all the ideas and put together a report for the chancellor in the upcoming months, with both a summary of the input and recommendations for what steps the university should take to move forward without Chief Alinowick.
We're excited. I'm very excited about it.
The debate over whether the chief is a racist mascot or an honored symbol has been happening for years, even though he was officially retired in 2007. I decide I'm going to ask attendees at today's event questions that have been on my mind about this issue, starting with Rahul Raju. He's a senator with the Illinois student government.
Does it surprise you that this is still an issue in 2018?
Yes, every single day, relentlessly. And I can say with confidence that that is true of a lot of students.
Raju says a new mascot and new traditions would help provide some finality.
The university needs to move forward, acknowledge the history of the chief and the deep offense it caused, and confront our history of appropriating Native culture.
Ann McClary is an alum who sees it differently. She was in the Marching Illini in the late 70s and says the intent of the chief was always to honor.
I feel like so many things in our society today are pick a side and no one tries for yes and. Yes, help Native Americans. Yes, have work study trips. Yes, have more scholarships. But also, yes, can we honor the chief again? It's an important part of our history. Why does it have to be erased?
Edit, not erase, she says. Retired U of I English professor Carol Spindell authored a book on the controversy over Native American mascots, and she says the ongoing saga is hurting the university.
People are very determined to hang on to it. It's always surprising how much people seem to care more about the chief than the well-being of the institution.
Spindell's referring to pro-chief alumni who she says cause unnecessary divisions. Margaret Borchers Cuddle also feels the issue is hurting the U of I, but for an entirely different reason.
Okay, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. They're losing money by being negative.
Cuddle's the daughter of the first Chief Alinowick, the late Weber Borchers, who started the tradition in 1929.
A lot of the chiefs have come and visited Daddy before he died. They come and see me, and they will leave nothing to the University of Illinois in their wills because the chief is not here. They have lost millions upon dollars.
One thing that both sides agree on, that prior university administrators didn't do enough to bring about a resolution to the chief issue a decade ago. So says Barcelo, the chancellor's special assistant.
From what I understand, I certainly wasn't here back then, but the institution probably wasn't as proactive as it needed to be in terms of doing follow through, in terms of how to heal, you know, from this.
But Barcelo says the time to move on is now. I asked Cuddle what she thinks.
I don't think it's possible to go forward because people are set. They miss it. They loved it. The chief is still a strong part of a lot of the people's lives. Maybe not of the young people in college right now, but their fathers and mothers and their grandparents.
Raju from student government says he's also not confident these initiatives to move the campus forward will succeed because the same dialogue has been happening for years and nothing has changed. But most of all, he wishes the Native American community was more involved in these conversations.
Not that we should expect that emotional labor from them, or like we demand their presence every time we're talking about this, but that I wish we had the right voices at the table more often than we do.
He says they're the ones who face real harm every day from the chief's continued presence on campus, and it's their well-being that should be considered above all. I'm Christine Herman.
And I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. All of us at GLT have two important words we want you to hear. Thank you. Nearly 500 people contributed during the latest fund drive.
I'm GLT financial supporter Alexis Wolstein.
I'm Dan Lannon.
I'm Carolyn Pitts.
We're grateful so many of you value NPR and GLT and everything we do, but guess what?
The fund drive may be over, but it's not too late for you to contribute.
We fell a little short, so we hope you'll take the time to contribute.
Pledge at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You have the opportunity to foster budding artistic talent in the community with a Phantom of the Opera-themed event. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Gala at the Galleries is coming up on May 19th at 6 p.m. That's going to be at the University Galleries. It's presented by the ISU Friends of the Arts. Board members Jerry Antonini and Sarah Smelser say the Friends of the Arts is comprised of alums, community members, faculty members, and students. In short, Smelser says they're interested in supporting the arts in our community.
So we have a lot of ideas and concerns in mind, and that's why we get together as a group and celebrate the arts, honor the arts, showcase the arts, and that's the purpose of this year's gala.
So you will be raising funds with this event. Where do the funds go, Jerry?
They go mainly to two places. One is scholarships and the other is grant projects. Last year, Friends of the Arts gave $40,000 to student scholarships and then $15,000 in grant projects.
Does the gala have a theme, Jerry?
This year, they're doing a Phantom of the Opera theme.
Ah.
And what that basically means is that we have some decorations, some costume-type things that if people want to wear a Phantom mask, or if they have just in their closet happen to have an 1890s opera gown they want to wear.
You know, I do. It's right next to my go-go outfit.
That's right. We do have a piano player with us this year, and I believe they are going to be playing some Phantom of the Opera music.
So you have two auctions going on. Tell me about the auction, Sarah.
Well, one auction is a silent auction. That auction is a collection of art objects that have been contributed or donated by local artists. We have Ken Cashian, who's a photographer in town, Jeffrey Bess, who's a painter in town, Jan Brandt, who's a wonderful do-everything woman about town.
She does a lot with fiber these days.
She does, an installation, and she's actually donated some wearables, which I think will stand out. Grace Sheese is a local ceramicist. So we have community artists. We have alumni who are local but also have mailed in work. We have work coming from New York City. We also have scholarship and grant recipients that are current students as well as alums. And we have graduate students. We have faculty. There's a whole range of artists that have been very generous with us.
And that's for the silent auction.
That's for the silent auction.
And the other one?
The other auction has fewer objects, and it focuses more on experiences.
That's really hot right now, doing experiences. So what sort of experiences do you guys have up for auction?
We have some that we have brought back year after year because they've been so popular.
So you mean like the one where the ISU Big Red Marching Machine spells out your name on the football field?
That's a popular one, yes. And there's also the Year of Pi.
Whoa. A Year of Pi? Not P-I, but P-I-E.
P-I-E. So once a month, a pie is delivered to the recipient. And there are all kinds of pies. Fruit pies, cream pies. We have an ex-board member who's an excellent baker, and he has contributed that experience. We also have a year of chocolate, and the year of chocolate is thanks to the board, and each person on the board has picked a month in which they will contribute a chocolate item to the recipient of that experience. We also, on campus, have a master fight choreographer. His name is Paul Denhart. Yes, he's not to be missed. And he has donated a swashbuckling lesson.
Does that include wearing a puffy-sleeved shirt?
The puffy shirt is maybe optional, but that's a really popular item.
Another popular event, every year we auction off the chance to conduct the ISU Symphony Christmas concert, the song Sleigh Ride. And that's, I believe, in the past we've offered three, because there are three Christmas concerts every year. And in the past they've also offered three chances to conduct that song.
Does a little lesson come with that, or what?
You get a session with the conductor and a practice session with the symphony. In the past, I know they've included a baton and a copy of the music. But I don't think you really have to know what you're doing. It's such a popular song,
too.
The musicians could just close their eyes and play it.
That's Jerry Antonini and Sarah Smelser, board members of the Friends of the Arts. The Gala at the Galleries is coming up May 19th at 6 p.m. at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. For a link to get tickets, go to the Datebook page at WGLT.org. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The gala also offers opportunities to volunteer to help raise funds for the students of the arts, or you can offer to help sponsor the event. You're listening to Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas. The Mesthetics is not Fugazi 2.0. Yes, the same rhythm section that drove Fugazi's influential punk hardcore sound for 15 years now drives the experimental rock of Mesthetics. And yes, many Fugazi fans are thrilled the quartet has partially reassembled into an instrumental trio. But the Mesthetics is a different band with a different sound. Drummer Brendan Canty and bassist Joe Lally are that rhythm section that now works alongside guitarist Anthony Parag in the Mesthetics, which plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight. GLT's John Norton caught up via Skype recently with Canty to talk about Mesthetics and Fugazi.
Nirvana, Bad Religion, Red Hot Chili Peppers, they're just some of the bigger names among many that cite Fugazi as an influence. But that just scratches the surface. Even businesses in Bloomington Normal are named after Fugazi songs, including Night Shop, where the Mesthetics play tonight, and Waiting Room Records in Normal, which owner Jared Elkhorn named after this song from Fugazi's debut album. Fugazi veteran and now Mesthetics drummer Brendan Canty says he is humbled by the accolades, but said Fugazi's initial aspirations were to just stay together.
We had spent a lot of time playing in bands where people would just, split and go off to college or whatever. And that, you know, Ian was in Minor Threat, and we were in, Gee and I were in Rites of Spring. So initially, at about 19 or 20 years old, which is how old I was when Fugazi started, you know, I wanted to play. I wanted to take it seriously. I wanted to get in the van and play every night of the year somewhere in the world. And that was, I think, the ultimate driving force behind most of the band was the functionality of it. And like, we all want to do this. We all want to be on the road. We want to play, you know, seriously and hard and put the work in that needs to happen.
And as you mentioned, it was around the time Nirvana hit, who also had been a big influence on that band as well. But it took 5 or 6, 7 years for you to actually get noticed by the record labels. And at that time, you were working on this this punk, funk, jazzy or avant-garde thing that wasn't mainstream. But they started looking back and going, maybe there is something here. Were you guys hip to that you thought you were onto something by the time they found you?
We never really changed our motivating principles, which was like basically keep challenging ourselves. And we didn't have, like I said, we didn't have like enormous aspirations besides getting on the stage and trying to play as hard as we could. You know, I mean, we're really the number one goal every day is to get on the stage and play to your best ability.
What a get to the aesthetics in just a second here, Brendan, I promise. But we have to address the fact that there are two businesses here in Bloomington Normal that are named after Fugazi songs. This is the kind of influence that band had. Waiting Room Records and Uptown Normal, named after the song on your very first album, right? And yeah. And Night Shop, the place you're going to be playing, also named after Fugazi's song. Let me ask it this way. When you're in the band, were you aware of the influence you guys were having at the time? Or when did that happen, and what were you feeling at it all?
I think it's part of human nature never to feel like you've arrived somewhere. So I never really felt at the time that we had arrived anywhere per se. We were just basically nose to the grindstone, fingers in the dirt, like all the time.
But the influence you were having on other people, were you sensing that at any point?
Well, people were showing up for sure. I mean, we were playing, we were selling, you know, 250,000 records a pop, you know, and it was, so people were showing, people were buying the records, and, you know, people were coming out of the shows were getting bigger in certain places, but we were also, you know, we were together for 15 years, and so we were constantly trying to book tours that we would play. Yes, we would play three nights in New York, but then we'd also play in Hoboken for 200 people, or we'd play in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, or we always, you have to get from one place to another, and you're always playing kind of smaller, out-of-the-way places. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're well-known or famous for the right reasons, which I appreciate, and I know I talk to people every night at aesthetic shows where they tell me that they've been influenced by us. So I'm not going to call them liars. I really appreciate all the kind words. Just for the sake of humility, like, I'm really honestly trying to keep my sanity. Just say, like, I really appreciate all when people say that. I love it, and it really means the world to me.
The name of the song is Night Shop. It's a Fugazi song, and we're speaking with one of the founding members, the drummer Brendan Canty, here on GLT Sound Ideas, who is in town to play Night Shop in downtown Bloomington with his new band, The Mesthetics. And this is a much different band. This is a trio. You don't have a lead singer. You don't have a singer, period. And you're teamed with your former Fugazi member, Joe Lally, the bass player. And you're rounded out by guitarist Anthony Pirog as well. First of all, it's been a while. Has it been a while since you played with Joe? And what is the chemistry like between the two of you now in this new setting?
It's amazing. Yeah, it's been like finding a long lost limb.
Yeah,
he's just a fantastic bass player. Number one, he was over in Rome for the last 8 years. So when he moved back, we started playing almost immediately here and there. Mostly on his stuff, which is a little quieter. And then I was listening to some of the things that he had brought back with him from Italy that he'd been writing, and he'd been playing with some more, you know, some more out there jazzos. And so I said, oh, well, I know this guy who I've been, you know, the Anthony, who I've been going to see and who I was a huge fan of. And I said, well, let's go see if we can get him in and play with him a little bit. And as soon as Anthony came in to play with us, it just really clicked almost immediately.
Well, and in Fugazi, you and Joe were the rhythm section behind a couple of singers and guitarists, and now you're the rhythm section for a single guitar player. What's different about writing songs where you're not writing vocals? Are you writing the songs as well?
Yeah, we're bringing stuff in. Both Joe and I are bringing some stuff in, but Anthony is really kind of a bit of a genius, I have to say, and he has so many great ideas. He's bringing in a lot of it. The lion's share of the initial push of the record was from him. So it's I'll tell you how it's different, in that we can talk about something and bring it to fruition within, you know, we can talk about it on the way to a show and try it out that night. And we can also we can write headers and come up with more vague ideas and just throw them out there live. So it's really much, it's much more from the hip. you know, and
are you improvising a lot when you're playing
right,
with the mystery?
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot of improv, a lot of improvising. You know, it's faster and it's. I liken it to trying to read the license plate of a car that's about to hit you. Like you're just constantly.
There's an analogy. Like,
you're just constantly like trying to read it, you know, and that happens over and over again, or catching baseballs in a batting cage. Like those two things, like there's just stuff coming at you all the time. And so you're just trying to keep your ears open, keep your head open, trying to create this, like the sound, this collective sound out of material that's coming at you constantly.
So when you're playing or playing live, are you quoting any Fugazi songs while you're on stage?
No, we're not quoting any Fugazi songs. We do we quote a little Ornette Coleman and some Sonny Chirac, but we don't you know.
Well, then maybe that dovetails into my final question I want to ask you. What musical satisfaction are you getting out of playing with the Mysthetics?
Well, it's just been incredibly reinvigorating. You know, to be out there and to feel completely challenged and playing to the toppest of my abilities anyways, to feel like I'm getting better as a musician every night, and to be playing with somebody, the two guys who are as insanely talented as them, and to also know that they're like lovely people who are doing it for all the right reasons, and to feel like we're growing this thing together organically from scratch, and that we're making challenging music and trying to make instrumental music. It's all really, those are all difficult and interesting things and challenging. And if there's one thing I've learned is that if you're not challenged, then you're not doing anything.
Former Fugazi drummer Brendan Canty speaking via Skype with GLT's John Norton. Canty and former Fugazi bandmate Joe Lally play Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight with their new band, The Mysthetics. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite music podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find all of the Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton and Laura Kennedy and Judy Valente. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.